This afternoon we explore the topic, Awakening the Sleeping Giant. When D.H. Lawrence was out here writing back to his wife's sister, he said, "You've never seen anything so nothing, nullus, niente, nictus, as life here in Australia. Australians are all meaninglessly on the go. But there is something strange about this great country. It's like an unawakened giant. When it wakens, the world will notice something new and special." I happen to believe you and I share a moment of the nation's history. And if we can tap into our own narrative from way back, even before we thought we knew God to this point, if I'm effective this afternoon, I'll show you, whether you've got the courage to see it or not, that you are made for this moment. I want to share with you some stories of how God works and how subtle the voice of the Spirit is. And it is a still, small voice, and one that requires a certain degree of attention to make sure we don't miss it. Just to encourage this, I'd like to frame all I say with a verse that's journeyed with me over many years. Luke 12:32. "Don't be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom." Let's look at it quickly. "Fear not, little flock," the Authorized used to say. You know, there are 366 fear nots and peace be unto yous in the Bible. One for every day of the year, including leap year. Why? Because he knows we need it. Zolzhenitsyn said it, and he was quoting, I think, Winston Churchill, that the fundamental virtue is courage. Without courage, there is no truth. Without truth, every other virtue ceases to have meaning. Love without truth is not love. Creativity without integrity is not creativity. I find it interesting in Revelation 21:8, it says, "But the fearful, the unbelieving," then the list goes on. I have a sneaking suspicion in 200 years from now, when we look back, the thing we'll regret the most was that we let our fear interfere with our trust. And we didn't take those steps. We didn't enjoy the full-blooded adventure that was ours. We were sensible and safe. Well, folk, you can either have safety or adventure, but you can't have both. And I'm here to call you to battle this afternoon. To ask you, are you ready to lay aside some comfort and face some fear? Interestingly enough, as I've spoken to Aussies over the years, I'm convinced there are two main things that stop them from coming to Christ. Many times I've been seduced into arguments about the reality of God and the veracity of the Bible, but they were almost never really the issues. There seem to be two issues for me. One, they were scared if they started that they couldn't keep it up. In their heart of hearts, they knew there was something in this lifestyle that was right. But their own damaged esteem and their incapacity to receive grace, even though it was their most favourite song, and they really couldn't believe they'd be able to keep it up. And they hate hypocrisy. It's been said by Donald Horne, "Aussies can smell bull a mile off." And they didn't want to be a part of it. Distorted but true. The other one was they feared what their mates would think. They feared what their mates would think. "Fear not, little flock." Notice the language, not big crowd, with the big budget and the big program. "Fear not, little flock. For it's your Father's." We've already had a look at what that means. Whatever damage there has been in the past, there is a Father that knew all about it. But that Father has given you a really new train set for Christmas. "For it's the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." What is the kingdom? "Our Father who art in heaven, holy is your name, your kingdom come."
by your will being done on earth as it is in heaven.
He wants to manifest his will and nature in time and space through a uniting of our wills with his. And the gates of hell cannot prevail. This is our destiny. Fear not, little flock, for it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Let me tell you some stories of the coming of the kingdom. Some moments that could have been missed that weren't. And tie it into the story, I think, you've been invited to write a chapter in, of the awakening giant here in this country. Let me go back to before the First World War. Some missionaries from the London Missionary Society were sent out to what was then known as Abyssinia. Later on we'd come to know it as Ethiopia. They worked valiantly in a little valley, and six converts came to Christ. They rejoiced as they sent news back to their prayer support team that these six people had come to Christ from out of the tribal peoples. The people back home were so excited that they immediately sent some building materials out and some clothes so these people could really become full Christians. So up they put up their little building made out of corrugated iron, a little pedal organ, and they gave them these beautiful pinstripe suits and starched shirts and lovely ties so they could come off to Sunday morning at 11 o'clock and worship. Bit difficult because they were very long in the legs, more than the most of the British, and the trousers only came halfway up their legs and flapped like a flag at their calves. But they looked beyond that because they were so intense and sincere. Another problem is they were spent so many long years walking barefoot, they could never find shoes that really fitted, so they overlooked that and they felt sanctified at least from the waist up, at least in the eyes of the missionaries. They would come dutifully at 11 o'clock and pump away in the little organ and try to sing the songs, which were kind of a different meter and a kind of a different rhythm to what they were used to, but they tried very hard because they wanted to love God as well as they knew how. This went for a while, and then some of them started nodding off to sleep and feeling guilty about it. Maybe they were losing God's spirit or something. The missionaries were very concerned that all of a sudden the work had come to a screeching halt. Was it sin in their lives? Was there something wrong in the teaching? And they spent hours on their knees confessing every little speck of dirt they'd ever could bring to their mind, thinking that this may free up the blockage. Around about this time, a character by the name of Mussolini thought he would reactivate or reinvent Charlemagne's Holy Roman Empire, which was never Holy Roman nor an empire, but that didn't bother Mussolini. He looked around somewhere where he could show the might of Italy at the time, somewhere where his mighty armies could run in and show their prowess as fighting people. So he looked around for this little place they call Ethiopia now and thought, they've only got spears and shields, they're about our match. So he sent in these tanks and bombers and all the rest of it, and they resisted more ably than he considered because they had another thing called courage. For time being, the missionaries cleared out. It was all getting a bit too hot to handle. It was a very emotional time as they parted with this little group. Already one of the converts had fallen away. And the missionaries feared that they would never see this little church again. They thought it was the end of the line. They hopped on their boat, went home, and spent hours, and I think probably that was part of the miracle that was about to happen, on their knees continuing to pray as well as they knew how. Time being, the war didn't quite come to this village enough to cause disruption. And these five of the six who were left thought, now what do we do now? Well, we keep on gathering. Yeah, but they had a kind of a watch and they knew when to gather. When is that? We don't have that one of those watches, and it's obviously very important that you come at that time. Maybe we can remember because it's when it's hottest. Okay, so there's some kind of... This God is very concerned that you get purified with heat, obviously, so we'll come at the hottest part of the day and we think we'll serve him. After a couple of weeks, trying to remember the songs, they're starting to feel guilty about the fact that the songs were getting lost and their own rhythms were keeping in. And one had a bit of a problem because a doc had done something on his tie and he knew this was a holy piece of garment that he had to wear, or he displeased God. And he was worried if he washed it like other things, it might destroy it. And he was in a real fix. So he decided to wear it anyway and put up with the aroma. And he knew that God would be pleased about this. Eventually, another one had a difficulty. When he put his shirt on, it started ripping because it was pretty big across the shoulder blades. So he pulled it back on again and put his coat on. But that ripped right up the middle. So he had to kind of hold it together as he came like this. And life was getting a bit uncomfortable. One had lost his belt and his trousers kept on falling. But they still wholeheartedly would come and sing praise as well as they knew and start making up songs and making up sermons. One of them said, "I keep on falling to sleep. I'm wondering if I'm spiritual enough. Do you think God would mind if we didn't do it in the heat of the day, like we normally do it in the village where we kind of do our meetings before the sun gets up, sit around the campfire? Well, let's try it. If the fireball from heaven doesn't drop on us, it might be all right." And by the way, I've lost my trousers. You think it's unholy coming just with this kind of lap thing? Well, let's try it. I mean, maybe we're all lost anyway, and maybe they'll have to start again when they come back after the war. They went and found their trousers were very uncomfortable sitting down as they normally squatted. And so they took them off altogether. And they started clapping and singing and rejoicing. And said, "This is fun. What shall we do it after the sun goes down at night?" And they started talking with each other, and they came at night, and they started making up songs. And some of their friends said, "Since you got this foreign religion, you guys have become very snobbish." "What do you mean?" "Look, we can hear the parties you guys are throwing, and you never invite us. What's wrong with us? Don't you remember your old friends?" "Well, it's really not a party." "What do you mean?" "Well, we're just worshipping our God. Can we come and watch? That sounds like fun." Eventually the war is over, and the missionaries return. And guess what they discover? The whole valley had come to Christ. Mind you, they didn't recognize the tunes terribly much. But within all the tunes, there was the recognition that the heavens declared the glory of God. And His Son had come to earth to repair the broken relationships, to express love in a new way, and to free the human spirit from the darkness, to find its place and its destiny before God. Similarly, in Korea, there was a bunch of Koreans who came to faith way, way back through some Chinese Christians. They were merchants. And they longed to have a church in their own native country. So they came back and shared the story, and some were fascinated by this new faith. And they requested that a missionary would be sent. His name was Thomas. And as I understand the story, he came with a donkey train laid it down with Bibles. He arrived in Korea, and the Buddhists had never seen a white man before, so they cut off his head. Ghastly. This was a real tragic moment for these little band of Christians. What are we going to do? If we ask some more to come, they will cut their heads off too. What will we do? The word got back, and their friends back home prayed. And God seemed to honor that prayer. They were bewildered. All they had was this translation of the Bible that they just took literally. Nobody was there to instruct them in it. They opened up at the book of Acts. They thought that was the place to start. And nobody told them you had to worship on a Sunday. So they gathered daily for prayer and breaking of bread, as the New Testament said. And it says you share things in common. So they started doing that. And a case could be put from that day to this, even through the Korean War, an unbroken morning prayer meeting has gone on from that day till this. And Korean Christianity is an interesting creature. Every now and then you'll hear them sing songs that come straight from the 50s in America. But there's another part to do with the way they pray. They stand up and all pray out loud at the same time and just go for it. Nobody taught them to pray. But somehow in this bridal form of prayer, they're sending missionaries out all over the world. And I had the joy in May of last year to be ushered in to the Olympic Arena in Seoul. 100,000 people crammed the arena. And they all stood and cheered as about 5,000 Christian leaders from around the world came in. And that night, 70,000 university students committed themselves to the mission field. 2/3 of the Korean army are born again believers. Something happened. What are the themes that join the two stories? I put it to you, the theme is they both just did what felt normal. Out of a love for God and a longing to see his kingdom come, they were normal. I don't know about you, but I'm fed up with being religious. Are you? I think there's some wonderful news that's breaking out for us. And that is, you can be you and thoroughly used of the Holy Spirit. In fact, if you're not you, you won't be used of the Holy Spirit. There is a place where your heart and mind connect in love for God. And out of that, a love for others grows and a healing of your own esteem. You've heard that somewhere before, the first and great commandment. It's not as if you have to put a lot of effort into that. Yes, suffering may come later, and there's a part of you that wants to run away from that. I'm reminded of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. When one whole side of him, yes, wanted to get away from the stress of what the cross was about. He was not a masochist. But he said, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. That's the kind of suffering. It says in the book of Hebrews, which of you have resisted sin unto blood? Beads of sweat, becoming beads of blood, that's happened before in human history. The only difference is nobody's gone through that and lived. When the trauma of shock has been so profound and the blood vessels ruptured, the people died of shock. Such was the case for Christ when he was becoming sin for us. We are told in the book of Isaiah, his soul was made an offering for sin, not just his body. But he became sin for us. Something of a traumatic nature took place that we'll never have to know. Yes, there is a suffering that comes. It is not easy. It's not simple. But there's another sense in which when you serve God, you know another kind of freedom. I want to tell three more stories, if I might, and tie them into this remarkable phenomenon that's become known as the Aussie Awakening. In 1993, there's a remarkable story. I was coming up to Easter 93, and I was handling a lot of press interviews and whatever, and I was exhausted. We were short on people on the ground to hold it together. Already hundreds of cities and towns were doing their Easter festivals, and we were short-staffed and getting materials out to support them, but it was going well. But I got a phone call. I won't bore you with the whole story, but it said, Mel, look, I think you ought to put a bid in for a radio station in Melbourne. And I thought, this is a joke. 2 days before Easter, and this is a joke. Well, I'll make two phone calls just in case it's the voice of the Spirit, and I just want to say a pastor by. I made two phone calls. The one was a friend of mine who's a station manager, and I thought he would say, no, it's stupid, it's not a good idea, but he got all excited, which was a worry. And then I thought, well, this is a Melbourne station, it shouldn't look like a bunch of Sydney people are coming in to run it. I'll ring up a friend in Melbourne and just see if they know of anybody in network family who may be interested. And it was a Christian man, a clergyman as it turns out, and I told him the story and he went quiet. And he said, do you realise what you've done to me? And I said, what? What do you mean? I thought I'd offended him. I couldn't tell how. He says, you've just blown my world apart. What do you mean? I simply asked you for the names of others. He said, no, 2 days ago I was praying. And as I was praying, in a way that normally doesn't happen to me, it was as if the Spirit of God said to me, what do you want? You're praying, but do you know what you want? And I was prattling on with all of these religious things, praying for my family and my church, but what do I really want? It's an obvious question, but I've never faced it. And I worked it over in my heart. Yes, I want some of my family's resources to be liberated for the kingdom. And he said, well, the Spirit of God said, I've been waiting for you to pray that prayer for a while. So I went and saw my solicitor. There's some complications I have to fight through because there's this complicated family business structure. And the solicitor told me the story. Yeah, it was yesterday, and you ring me up today. I've got $500,000 for you. And I should have been very excited, but I thought, oh no. There is a whole story about how that eventually panned out, and we were given the bid, and eventually, just in passing, we won the bid, but they wanted us to lie. It was a very interesting moment. It was the AWA network, and I may be committing libel or defamation by even saying this, so I don't know if it should be recorded even. They wanted to say we had done due diligence. They hadn't given us all the books. There was a bit of a fiddle going on, but as far as we were concerned, we'd done our projected budgets, and we knew we had business lined up and we'd have survived anyway, but it was wrong to consider lying. And so they said, we'll go to the next bidder. We said, if that's what it means for us to lie, we can't go with it. So we still feel that radio station is ours down there, and who knows, one day it might be. But in the middle of this, I'm telling you all of this just to tell you, it was just a mad time. This other phone call came in saying, Mal, we want you to speak at a mayoral breakfast next Tuesday. Well, I survived with my family by hanging on till Easter and then having a time with the family, the first 2 days of which I sleep, and then I wake up and say, I think I know you from somewhere. I think you're my wife or something of that order. And they cope with that, assuming that I'm there at that time. But this would have meant it would have intruded in that very sacred family time. And I can still remember, and it's been haunting me from that day till this, how I nearly said no. It was not sensible. There was no way, given everything else I had to manage, that this seemed to be a right thing. But this little voice said, do it. I said, no. Just hang on. And I said, all right. And I can still remember, I was like a zombie. You know, every little, my last remaining brain cell was about to collapse, you know. And anyway, I flew in. It was an international flight that you get a domestic seat on. And I flew in late that night, and it had been mucked up with the motel and all this sort of stuff. And then I went and I spoke. And there was a strange feeling. The place was packed with all of these people. And I could pick the Christians. They were on one side and they were cringing. But all the rest were alive with tears in their eyes. I was too exhausted to really care what anybody thought that morning. I just shared as God's Spirit gave the grace. Now, I can't use all the language that's about to come. It would be interesting for you to hear the whole thing and it sits you. But after this, there's a table of about five people. And they said, hey, Mal, come out here. And I come out. Hey, Mum. I can't use all the language. Thing wrong, mate. Honey, where have you been? What do you mean? I never heard anything. Right. And they're all nodding and agreeing. There's the local mayor. Who was talking to me was the local radio station manager, the head of the Chamber of Commerce, all of them were there. And they said, mate, this is what we need here at Ipswich. He said, we're in a hole. Our kids are committing suicide, we're unemployed, we've lost our way. We keep on whipping up the stuff and bringing marketing people in, it's just got nowhere, and you've got just told. Mate, if I'd have known it was been like, you've got to come back. We want a date from you this morning. You've got to come back. And I'm going to give 10 grams worth of advertising. We'll get them. We know how to get them there. But we didn't realise the product was so good, mate. And there's more to it, but I won't say any more than that. And eventually that would happen, and I'd go back, and there'd be banners everywhere, and the place would be alive, and the football oval was filled with people, and we had this great family thing, and it was a remarkable time. It's been going on ever since. A remarkable moment. But there was something behind it. I didn't have a clue at the time. It was to come out later. And what was it? In the previous 6 months, there was this character who had been a live Christian man, but he got into business, and very often, as is the case, you don't own businesses, they get to own you. And with the recession, he got a big shock. He realized, really, he didn't own the business. The bank owned the business, and he didn't know how long he'd have the use of it for. It was a shopping center, as a matter of fact. On one occasion, out of this concern, he brought all the tenants together and said, I just want to hear how you're going, because he knew if three of them fell over, he was in big trouble. Got all the tenants together and had them go around and say how things were. It was worse than it had expected. It came to one person, and this man said, my wife walked out on me last night. And he just broke down in tears. Now, one of the problems with communication It's a bit like toothpaste. Once it's out of the tube, it's hard to push it back in again. And here he is, blubbering away, and it's all, and everybody's looking at their shoes and trying to divert their eyes. In the middle of the setting, this prompting rises in him and says, pray. He thinks, oh my goodness, I've called a tenants meeting, not a prayer meeting. And this voice came again, pray. Pray with me. He says, no, I can't be hearing this right. And then he said, do you mind if I pray? The response was, can you? I think he was so tentative about it, it really tempered the way he prayed. It was a priestly prayer. He got inside the skin of this brother who was in tears and brought everybody who was there feeling the stress, and he just prayed and loved them and expressed the mercy of God. And they had never ever heard or been lifted and cared for in a prayer like this before. He, in his attempt to be honest, he prayed. He said, I prayed a little longer than I should have because I was too scared to look up and make eye contact with them. I knew my relationship would be changed permanently after this. But he looked up and all of them were in tears. I think two of them that day had the courage not to get converted. They would then gather every week, all throw in $5 and buy a plate of sandwiches and hear each other's story and pray for each other, just like they'd heard him pray. This was what was now normal. And they threw some money in to help this bloke and they pulled him back from bankruptcy. They supported each other and used each other's networks. And it went on week after. And I said, this is fantastic. Why haven't we ever understood this before? Now, this is very interesting, because at this stage, nobody's thought about going to church. It hasn't even entered their head. That is not even on the agenda. But they're starting to write little poems, and they're starting to read the good news, and say, what does this mean? And what does this mean? And I found, this is it, look what I found. And there was an energy that's coming alive in these hardened, struggling business. Now, I've got to tell you, last I heard, there are now 8 cells of them around Ipswich, and they're expecting to have 30 going throughout the business district of Brisbane. But it's all been so normal. Now, then they say, hey, listen, this is great. We've got to share it with the mates. We're all in strife here in Ipswich. We've got to help them. How can we do it? And this guy called Hans, he's written one of these books down there on reaching business people. He said, well, I know the bloke. You often hear him on the radio up here. QFM, that's Mel. I can get him up. So we get him up and have a mayoral thing and bring all of our mates in. And so that's what they did. Now in Ipswich, they had leased their cars from the character up the road and their computers and bought radio time with them and bought a page of advertising. So they knew all the mayors and all the rest of it. And there was a network that the church never reaches. And they said, listen, we're going to throw on this thing. We're going to have a heritage day, even though it's after Easter. We get our act together as a community. We're going to bring this bloke up. He's fantastic. And you've got to come. And you've got to buy a table for 6 and pay for it. And they knew how to do it. And they actually made money out of this venture somehow. So all their mates turned up. And they had a couple of blokes to sing Waltzing the Children, a few of those things. And they then pushed me out. Here I was in this exhausted haze. And I just went for it. And there was one Christian group over there, and they'd never seen anything like this before. And they knew all of these other people and their reputations. You see, what they weren't ready for was just how responsive the hearts were. They did get me back, so they all worked hard. And I still think it was a mistake. They got me into prisons, into every high school, Catholics, you name them, they were all there. They rounded up 400 of the top leaders. And I had a seminar. I had to speak for 4 hours with dinner in between. And then there had been a great division between the church and the local political setting, being a Labour town, after the division in the 60s with the Labour Party and the Catholics and all the rest of it, the DLP. This town got split and they became quite anti-clerical, anti-church. And so there'd been a big division there. And the church, they would just not let move anywhere. But after this first event, some of them were out, they wanted me, they'd opened the new part to rebuild Ipswich. And in the centre there, they wanted me to, I thought it was a giggle, they asked me to come in and bless it. And so there was this big civic event, and it was really celebrating the painter, the artist, Darcy Doyle. And you'll notice he has a lot of little children, old Queensland houses and whatever. And God gave me the verse, you know, what is great? It's not how many servants you have, but how many people you serve. And he took to take a small child. And as you receive the child, you receive me. And I said, how will Ipswich become great? It's not the size of it, its economy, but will its children say it was great? Because you had love, you had the spiritual virtues that brought love and wholeness and community to birth. Hardly a dry eye in the place. The soil was so rich and bright. Now I've got to say, on the way through, there was some resistance to some of the churches before we got to that point, which was the second phase of the business. Why? I'm not knocking this, but I'm just telling you how it was. There were some very large Pentecostal kinds of churches, and they just knew God was going to transform Australia from their little building. And so they would knock the walls down and get more in, and they would have, I'm not knocking it, but this was the consciousness. They'd have the band up here powering on, nothing wrong with any of that. And the assumption is they would stretch it and stretch it until the whole of Ipswich was inside, and then that would be it somehow. I don't know how they conceived it, but that was it. And when they heard this whole thing was taking off, and they weren't in the scenario, they said, this is New Age and it's wicked and it's a worry. And so we had some interesting meetings with them and gradually helped them find their place. And on the evening that I was to speak, and they had fireworks and local kids were there, and, you know, thousands were there, we actually gave them a role and we taught them how to pray a priestly prayer. And I'm thankful for the humility. They didn't stay out on the end of the limb and be brittle. They came in and they had a role. And he prayed a priestly prayer, carrying all the people in his heart, representing the Father heart of God. And you can hear this mood sweep over them. They don't know God is like that. At least the prodigal, when he was hungry, ate pig swill. When he starved, he wanted to come home to his father. Hey, there are a lot of people now who've eaten the pig swill and they're still starving. But here in this country, they don't know where the Father is. They don't know really what he's like. And there's this great sense of relief when they discover it. And to hear the crowd that night, and it's been continuing ever since. All the mates have got together now and they have this thing called Reconnect Magazine. And every household in the whole of Ipswich gets this Christian magazine. And they know how to make it pay with advertising and Christian material and all the rest of it. And it's a regular event. It's a regular event. He's now networking with, what's it called? Salespeople with a purpose or something or other. Dragging them in from all over the world now and starting to influence. But I keep on thinking, hey, 2 months. When we both could have been very sensible. And missed it. I don't know, does that haunt you? Does that haunt you? Maybe it's just me that's neurotic. You may be quite well adjusted. I wonder how many moments the Spirit of God has come and given an opportunity that would have turned the course of history. Okay, let me tell you another story. I love this dear brother. He was called by God, he's a Baptist pastor, been touched by the Spirit of God, and lovely brother, very humble, called by God into Wollongong. No offence to anybody here in Wollongong, but if God calls you to a church in Wollongong, you usually have a long discussion with God about it. You think you've got that right, God? I more have, you know, some other place in mind. And it's the... Got to be careful how much I say, because, you know, it's still extant and still happening. But there had been churches down in that part of the world where there had been divisions. When BHP threw the towel in and a lot of unemployment took place, the whole brittleness came into the area, and there were some very large churches, two large churches, and they thought they had all the answers, and people would go there because they could sit down and feel something of the strength, and a lot of little ministries and witnesses struggled to survive, and then they blamed their pastors and leaders, and some infighting took place, and they coped with these important problems by going up the street and starting again and all that sort of stuff, and they wouldn't make eye contact in the shopping centres and all this sort of stuff. So he's a young man with a young family. Lord, I don't know if I want to go into that situation. Anyway, he goes, and he's there a couple of weeks, and he hits this brick wall. And he says, oh no, this is what I feared. So, praise God, he then went up to, if you remember Wollongong, there's a big mountain looking down over the thing. He went up there and prayed. He got up there to pray, and he couldn't pray. As he looked down, he could see it all, and he knew what was down there. He wanted to say all kinds of things, but his own integrity wouldn't let him say what a part of him wanted to say. He knew he couldn't believe what he was wanting to pray. There was an incredible battle built up, and he just broke down sobbing. He didn't understand what that meant. He just broke down sobbing. All he knew was that there was some kind of release in that, and he knew God's love was there somewhere, but he couldn't articulate it. In the following week, maybe some of the elders noticed something in his body language, and they didn't want to lose him, so they said, hey, how about next Saturday you come for a game of golf with us? He said, oh, I've got an appointment. They said, what about before or after the appointment? He said, oh, look, I'll tell you. I'm going up there to pray. I said, that's all right, we'll come with you. So the next morning, six of these elders and deacons go up and they pray, but they hit the same thing. Now, he hadn't told them what had happened. He just thought it was a kind of a one-off thing. Have you ever been at a prayer meeting where there's this kind of embarrassing silence? It's not reflective silence where you know people are before God. It's as if nobody's got anything to say, and you wish somebody would say something to fill the air, at least with some noise, so the embarrassment would go. It was a bit like that. And then one of them, and they're real Aussie blokes, blue-collar Christian, started breaking down. And everybody was diverting their eyes, thinking, what is going? Maybe we're becoming charismatic. Woe is me. And then it just went through them. Within 3 weeks, there were 30 people praying. And they were finding their voice. He came to me, in the lead up to the Global March. And he came to me now, and I'm thankful for him. Hang on. He came up and he said, no, we want to have our own global march down here. At this point of time, in 1994, I was dreading it a bit. Because it seemed to be every man and their dog wanted to have the little marches. And I knew it would be compared to the gay Mardi Gras. I just wanted for the Christian community to get out of their boxes and come to the streets and become visible and show the world we are the largest minority. We don't have to hide. The parties that are fighting to control this country have nowhere near the numbers we have collectively. And I said, couldn't you hire some buses and come up and join us? And he wrestled with it and he was humble, but I'm thankful that he didn't come. I don't know if any of you came to the Global March. I want to know why you weren't there. I keep on wondering where my brethren friends are. We had 50,000 turn up in Sydney that year. We said to people there in front of the opera house, I'm sorry, folk, you can't sit down because one backside takes up as much space as 2 sets of feet. So you're going to have to stand. We wouldn't have had room for them. They had their march, 2,000 marched in Wollongong, which for them was wonderful. People who'd been divided came and marched together, and it wasn't just a march. It was an expression of a common concern, a common longing to be with God and his people in the heart of the culture in the moment. And God honoured that, and hearts were melded together, wounds were healed. Next news, there are 32 congregations meeting for prayer, not people. And they then established this thing called Illawarra 2000. And last November, they invited me to come down, and they're learning to be a bit political now, so they invited the local Anglican bishop to come and give a little word on unity, just to make sure he was there. And he came. And Wollongong Town Hall was packed out with over 800 people. And Christian leaders came up onto the platform, and look back to their people and say, we want to apologise. We have not been the source of unity we should have been. We acknowledge there is only one church in Wollongong, and that is Christ's church. The Bible says only by pride cometh contention. And it was fascinating just to observe this. Now, what is now fascinating to me is they now, and I believe it's true, they're using all of this material, different networks are forming, strategies are underway, and they're expecting for every breathing, living soul in the whole of the Illawarra, not just Wollongong, in the whole of the Illawarra, to receive the gospel in a warm, inviting way by the year 2000. His name is David Magruder. Once again, he had hit his give-up line. He could have missed it. He could have covered it up. It was so close. And I'm out of time. I wanted to tell you another story of a dear brother, an Aboriginal brother called Billy Bird. In Redfern, he's had it. His wife had died. Struggling to do ministry there. And some of the kids broke in and wrote rude words on his drop-in centre. And he just dropped to his knees and howled. He had finished. He was burnt out. And an old chair was just soaked with tears. There is no exaggeration. This is exactly what it was. He said, Lord, all I've tried to do is serve you. And then this voice, he says, it was as clear as God was speaking himself. He comes to me and says, you're just about ready, Bill. And he said, I saw this vision of reconciliation. And I just knew that if we kept on whinging about it, it would never happen. If we waited for the white man to understand, all the wrong things would happen. And it's for me to forgive, first of all. For me to take the initiative and challenge all my brothers and sisters to stop whinging and to take initiative. And so Bill Bird then starts moving, and we were struggling for the Olympics at this stage, and it was the year of the Indigenous people, and nobody had the courage to say no to him, or have we? Bruce said he put on this whole thing, Bob Hawke, and everybody turned up. He wanted me to come along and give him the word. High Court, they're all there. And he gets up and says, hey, listen, there's no future unless we reconcile. And there's no chance of reconciliation until we all meet personally the great reconciler himself. Hey, I couldn't have gotten away with what he said. And there was this something that was born there. And he's been an inspiration to others. And I've just come back from Canada. And the native people over there have been inspired by this dear brother. And they've just led this great sacred assembly, they call it. They saw their country just about to split up. The Quebecois, the French, the Francophones, and the English speakers, and they heard about this and the Canberra gathering. They want our Aboriginal people to come over and help them work it through, and they are calling them together instead of pointing the finger, saying, hey, listen, none of us is perfect, but how can we create a world where all of our children have a future? And we'll only find that as we rediscover ourselves as children of God, something beyond ourselves. They believe in something bigger than our own egos. And so a whole network is being built. Now here's the point. I want to finish it with you. Coming up again all over this country, I just wish it was a different way, but it's not. There'll be small groups who'll say, we want to reach out to our friends and neighbours. It'll be much easier to watch the news and be sensible. To mow the lawn, fix the garden, do all kinds of good things. But I've got no doubt God, by His Spirit, is speaking loudly enough so the humble, willing will hear. And He's calling them to their destiny. It's a gentle voice, it won't coerce. He says, see this? There's a deficit here in the community. A deficit of my glory, of my nature, of my fatherly love. Will you go over there? And all over this country last year, 500 cities and towns had ordinary little people struggle with their give-up lives and do it. The result is, I think, it's evangelistic history. 1 million Aussies. Gee, I wonder. If it's in 94 when the fires came through, what was haunting about that was some places just got demolished and the place next to them didn't even get a cent. Did you notice that? And even where I stand, it's quite interesting. I say these kind of, I know the stories. I go most of the afternoon telling you stories of people, ordinary people. The last thing in their mind was that they would be used. And even now, they still have an identity problem. I'm certain if I brought up these three people to tell you the story this afternoon, they would not have told it quite like this. A brother in Samaria did the same thing. He wants to tell the wonderful thing that's happening now. He doesn't want to live with the stresses and anxiety of when he too, a reformed brother, about to leave the ministry, he couldn't budge his church, and now they are changing the town, the city of St. Mary's. What do we believe? I'm not asking, what are your doctrines? Your life is going to demonstrate what you really believe. Your congregation is going to show the nature of its beliefs. Is it a place for the exhausted frail to come out of the storm? Praise God, why not? Or is it a place for people to come and get nourished so they can see the community with God's eyes and find their particular ministries out there? I spent time in Norway and had a wonderful time with this professor of theology. And he was moist-eyed and he said, now it had to happen in Australia. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, I believe what you blokes are about is the third wave of the Reformation. I said, that sounds a bit overdrawn. I'm just an ordinary Aussie. He said, no. He said, those manuals that you're showing me, you don't realise how profound. He said, if an American was doing it, it's not a knock, they'd have got their PhD in it, written a book that thick, and would have been so thorough they'd have had the last word on it, turned it into a ministry, done videos, CDs, and marketed it around the world. But these are ordinary people who are doing it and asking other people to add their chapter to it. It's not the last word, but the first step. And as I've looked at all the manuals, there is not one about what happens in that 1.5 hour Sunday morning. Everybody's fighting for their place at the pulpit. But none of that was about that, he said. You see, in the first part of the Reformation, we rediscovered the priesthood of all believers. That every one of us could come into the throne room of God. What we didn't need, priests or saints. Christ's blood had done all that was necessary for us to find our place as his children there. But we Lutherans still got dressed up in these funny clothes, got these pulpits, so we'd stand above them, had to do 4 years training, and we were still the professionals. In spite of what we said with our mouth and with our teaching, everything about the structure told them something else. And we were very focused on authority. And then the charismatic movement comes and it stuns us, and so many sensible people would get involved. You see, what they got was this experience of God's love, whatever you think about the theology of it, he said, and this sense that they could all have gift. But I think you're the third wave. He said, you are showing that we all have ministry. Every single one of us. It's not just here what happens on the platform, it's what happens out there. How much of the love of the Father is manifest so people can look into the eye of it, feel the warmth of it, feel welcome back, to feel the aching deficit of godlessness. We're coming up again this year. I wonder if you're ready to receive your ministry. There is a great giant out there. Not created by a wonderful evangelist who's coming. I happen to believe for too long as Aussies we've suffered from overseasure. If it doesn't come from overseas, it's not quite legitimate. No, the greatest of all evangelists is here and in your town. He's looking for company to go out and to look into the eyes of those who have felt needs and to demonstrate, not in word alone, but in the totality of your existence and sacrifice, what his love is like. This awakening giant is happening because people who don't have the time and don't have the money are willing to live with the stresses associated with those things to make sure it happens. as they say in the classics, if you want to do a thing bad enough, you find a way. If you don't want to do it, you find an excuse. I'm here to invite you this afternoon, even though we've lost some time, to challenge you. We've got 5 years. Do you want to find a way? Do you want to connect with those who are doing it? Let's do it. God bless you.